Before we get started on 19th and 20th century philosophy, it would be helpful, for the sake of review, those of you who have been in these courses previously, and especially helpful for those of you who have not looked at it at all, to have some idea of what precedes the 19th century in philosophy. Obviously, we cannot recapitulate all of that work that we've done in ancient and medieval philosophy and Renaissance and Enlightenment philosophy in 1 hour, but I'd like to kind of cover some of the high points just so we have a context in terms of which we can look at Hegel, who is the first major 19th century philosopher that we'll get to eventually. We go all the way back to the Greek period of philosophy, which is not where philosophy began. One of the distinctives of this course has been that philosophy began in the Garden of Eden, that all men are philosophers, and that every culture and every individual within culture has had to think philosophically and come to conclusions about the universe and man's place, and how he should live his life, and how he knows what he knows, and things of that nature. But if we go back to the Greeks, where many textbooks of philosophy begin, and look at the pre-Socratic period, the period of Greek philosophy prior to the time of Socrates, we'll see that the problems that the Greeks dealt with were, first of all, the problem of matter. What is the nature of the material world? Thales is thought to have started it all with his aphorism, "All is water." Now, he was probably wrong, you know, from a scientific standpoint in that assertion. But what's philosophically important is that Thales was attempting to find one principle, one unified principle that explains everything, to bring all of the particulars of experience into one kind of explanation or under one heading by way of explanation. And not everyone agreed with him. Others said all is air, more sophisticated approach. All is apeiron, the boundless. There must be something that is not water, that is not air, that is not this, that is not that, that is unbounded in its character. And so that sounds very abstract. What would the boundless be like? So the problem of matter was approached by the pre-Socratic philosophers. And then related to it, in an interesting way, the problem of change. How does the one unified thing that accounts for everything change? How is motion possible? If something is what it is, how can it become something different? Right? You were once 18 inches long, and now you're, you know, 4 or 5 feet long. How did you change? Are you the same person now? Is motion even rational? So the problem of change is addressed, and you get a couple of conflicting opinions on that. One says motion is an illusion. There is no change. Everything stays exactly what it is, but our senses deceive us. That never was a very popular philosophy, but it does seem, you know, to be profound in many ways. Others went to the other extreme and said everything changes all the time. You can't step in the same river twice, Heraclitus said. So there is no identity. Well, then if there's no identity, all kinds of philosophical problems arise. Okay? So if you have a man who's on trial for murder and there is no identity, why is he on trial for murder? So, I mean, how can you say that this individual sitting in this chair is guilty of what happened, you know, 8, 9, 10 months ago, if there's no identity? And if there's no identity, how then can we talk about anything? Because every time you mention something, you're referring to something at a particular point, but the time you mention it is after the point that you were. How could you ever talk? So philosophers struggled in the pre-Socratic period with what is the nature of reality, or what is the stuff of the cosmos, the problem of matter. They struggled with the problem of change, identity and change, motion, or what we might now call physical theory. the problems of physical theory, change and matter. In the process of arguing about these things, they also had to ask, how do we know if any of our answers are correct? Now, what is the source of our information, or how do we confirm or disconfirm different views of reality, different views of matter, different views of motion? And some thought that the way to justify your opinions was to trust your senses. Go look and see. You know, do some exploration. Look at the world and see if what you find out there matches up to your philosophy. Others took the approach, you can't trust your senses. Our senses deceive us. After all, you look down the way, the railroad tracks. You didn't know the ancient Greeks had railroad tracks, but they did. No. In our day, if you look down the railroad tracks, it appears that these tracks come together in the distance. Well, your senses are deceiving you. You should actually trust your reasoning. As what makes sense? How can you coherently account for the world? And so in the theory of knowledge, the pre-Socratics went back and forth as to whether reason or sensation should be the basis for our opinions and how we justify what we do. But the ancient Greeks also had to ask, whatever this world is and how we know about it, how should we live our lives? What should our attitude be toward life? What's life all about, Alfie? And how do you relate to other people? The problem of attitude and behavior. That's the pre-Socratic period. If I can stand back for a second before we get to Plato and Aristotle. If we just look at the pre-Socratic period, we get some idea of what philosophy is all about. Not that all of the problems of philosophy were directly addressed then or even addressed properly then, but we begin to see the nature of philosophical reasoning. And so let me give you a list of problems throughout the history of philosophy that begin to be illustrated in that pre-Socratic period. Philosophy is an effort to find explanations. How do things happen? Why do things happen? A desire to find explanations, and in particular, explanations that can be justified, not just some arbitrary opinion. And so philosophy necessarily leads us to ask, what should our method of reasoning be, our method of research, and what should our standards of proof be? What are our methods and our standards? And more particularly, as we try to explain things in this world, how can we resolve internal conflicts in terms of the things we believe? How can we take our different explanations that conflict with one another and resolve them? Now, why would explanations conflict with each other? Well, because some things are explained mechanically. You want to know, why did that tree fall down? An explanation that says, well, somebody took their axe and they minimized the base of the tree so that the weight and gravity were such that it toppled over and hit the ground. Now, that's a kind of explanation. Obviously, scientists could be more sophisticated, but you know what I'm talking about, a mechanical explanation. But now, if I ask, why did you choose to eat a burrito rather than a taco for lunch? You don't give the same kind of explanation. There you don't use mechanical explanation. You talk about desires and preferences or maybe even goals. You know, well, he's trying to set the world record for the number of burritos that people have ever eaten. Or he actually prefers refried beans to whatever. Now, that doesn't look like an explanation that's very similar to a chopping the tree down explanation. And you say, okay, well, then there's just a whole lot of explanations. Isn't it an interesting world in which we live? Until the two types of explanations conflict with one another, as in a courtroom. So now you have somebody who's being accused of murder. The prosecutor wants the jury or the judge to convict this man and to punish him, execute him, imprison him, whatever. Well, now we've got to decide, what kind of explanation do we use in a courtroom? Because if you use a mechanical explanation for why this man murdered so-and-so, then it doesn't do any good to punish him at all. It's really quite futile. Because, I mean, do you punish the tree for falling down when, you know, you've chopped it? Come on. And so there are certain, maybe physical, biological, chemical reasons, if you're more sophisticated, external sociological reasons why this man murdered another person. But punishing him makes no sense if you use the chop the tree down approach to explanation. And so now we're in a situation where we don't want to deny that the world is constructed in such a way that you can use mechanical explanations, but we seem to be making an exception in a courtroom. We don't use mechanical explanations in a courtroom. We use personal, moral, we look at desire, we look at purpose and things of that nature that have nothing to do with chopping trees down. So philosophy, to get back now to my subject, is the attempt to look at the underlying presuppositions by which we explain our experience and resolve the conflicts that arise. And so that leads us to try to understand nature. What is the natural world in which we live? Is it just matter in motion? What is matter? Is motion possible? Is there identity through change? When a river flows downstream, is it the same river? Is there identity to the river, even though it's always changing? And what is the relationship between the underlying stuff or matter of which all things are made and the changing appearances of the stuff? Now you start with a block of stone and some sculptor comes along and carves a buffalo out of it. All right? One day you look at it and it's this chunk, this rock, and another day you look at it and it's this polished buffalo. Obviously, the appearance has changed. Is there an underlying stuff or identity to that what was a block of stone? And this underlying stuff of which everything is made, is it the same for all things? Are there many kinds of realities? Or just one kind of reality? Does the world in which we live show purpose, or is it just going on aimlessly? So these are questions about understanding nature. Thirdly, philosophy raises questions about reason. Now I said thirdly. If you've been taking notes and listening closely, let me show you what I've said. First of all, philosophy is a desire to find explanations and to resolve internal conflicts in the way that we explain things. Secondly, I said philosophy is an attempt to understand nature, the world in which we live, the character of the world. What's it made of? What kinds of things? How many things? How are they related? Is motion possible? But now thirdly, philosophers have been concerned about reason. Is reason, man's reasoning ability, an instrument for obtaining objective knowledge of reality? And if it is, what are we doing when we reason? Or what are we doing when we reason properly? Is reasoning basically an extension of sensation, look and see? Or is reasoning stop and reflect, try to gain coherence in your thinking? be more abstract than just checking the facts with your eyes and your hands and ears and so forth. So the nature of reason, third major problem in philosophy. Then fourthly, by what values or standards should man live? Are these values objective, or is value only in the eye of the beholder? If values are objective, is the world purely natural? Because if everything that exists is natural, how could there be objective values? You don't find values in nature, have you? Has anybody found a value in nature yet? Walk through the forest and say, oh, look at that. Thou shalt not kill. I found it right here in the forest. Obviously, values are not the sort of thing you can find in the forest. Can't stub your toe on values. And so if nature is the whole of reality, can there be values? These are the sorts of questions that arise when we look at the question of value and also man. Is man morally distinct from the animals? Is he unique? In man, should his reasoning control his passion? What place should pleasure have in our decisions? Should we aim to be honorable? Is there something called justice between men? Should we be party animals or live for moderation? Should we aim for peace? Should we be selfish? Questions about value. So to put all this together, I guess ancient philosophy shows us that the task of philosophy is to get an answer to how we should view the cosmos, how we should view nature, and the relation of ethics to it, or the relation of value to it. And in the process of answering that, we have to know whether man's mind is self-sufficient. If there's a public truth that's accessible by man's reasoning, and therefore what is man's place and his dignity in this universe, what's the meaning of his life? Well, so ancient philosophy gets us underway. These are the sorts of issues that people are going to struggle with, and the difficulty in philosophy is that it appears that you can give a good answer to these questions, and then somebody else comes along and has an equally good answer, but opposite of yours, to those kind of questions. What's man's place in the universe? Are there values? Are they objective? Is man's reason sufficient? What is the nature of reasoning? And so one person gives an answer, and you say, oh yeah, that sounds right. Then somebody else says, no, that can't be right. And he gives an answer that conflicts with it, and that sounds good. Philosophy is frustrating in that way, but that's the nature of the beast. We come to the time of Plato and Aristotle, and with them in particular, I'm oversimplifying, but we see the development now of what's called systematic philosophical reflection. The reason we say it's systematic is that their precursors would work on isolated problems about what's the nature of reality, or how do we know what we know, or how should we live our lives, what value should we live for. And they might then pick up these precursors would have a main focus for their philosophy, and then they would touch on in passing, or maybe ignore altogether, the other kinds of questions we brought up. But in Plato and Aristotle, we see the example of men who wanted to look at the whole range of those questions that I've just listed for you and come up with an approach that can answer them and systematize them and organize them and integrate them. But as I indicated also, the difficulty is one man gives an answer, it seems pretty reasonable, then another guy comes along and criticizes him and gives something that also looks reasonable, and that's what you have in Plato and Aristotle. Plato gave a systematic approach to the nature of reality, how we know what we know, and how we should live our lives. He tried to get it all to hang together. Looks pretty good. His best student comes along and says, nah, that won't work. has these criticisms and offers an alternative world view, if you will, an alternative way of looking at nature, an alternative way of looking at man, an alternative way of looking at value and how we should live our lives. And I'm going to try to list for you Plato versus Aristotle here very quickly, contrasting their attempts to maintain objectivity, rationality, and morality. I want you to get that into your notes. It's important for you to see that both Plato and Aristotle, despite their differences, were trying to maintain objectivity to knowledge, the rationality of man's mind, and morality. The reason I say this is because later on, philosophers will start saying, well, if we can't resolve the differences between Plato and Aristotle and others, maybe we have to give up objectivity. Maybe we have to give up rationality. Maybe we have to give up morality. But a real quick contrast between the two first systematic philosophies. Plato emphasized transcendent form. Aristotle, immanent dynamic form. Plato emphasized transcendent form. Aristotle, immanent dynamic form. And for the new students, this calls for some explanation, doesn't it? Why do we call Huey, Dewey, and Louie ducks? What is it that unifies those three things out on the pond? And Plato said, well, there is the concept or form, the idea of duckness. You don't see that out on the pond, okay? The idea of duckness is not, you know, splashing water everywhere. Huey, Dewey, and Louie are doing that. And so for Plato, the form or idea of things doesn't exist in this world. It transcends this world, goes beyond human experience. It's not part of the material experience about us. Aristotle held that the form of duckness actually is in this world. You can't see it. It's not separate from the ducks, but the form of duckness is found only in the ducks and the impression that they make on our minds. So Plato, transcendent form, Aristotle, immanent form, and for him that form was dynamic. Form is what's helping the material world develop into what it develops. For Plato, the emphasis was upon unity, the oneness of things. For Aristotle, emphasis upon diversity, the manyness of things. Plato moved in the direction of rationalism. Aristotle, empiricism. How many of you are not familiar with the term empiricism? Okay, good. So Plato said, stop and reflect. He wants a rational answer. Aristotle says, go look. He wants to be empirical. Check what you're thinking against the world in which you live. In Plato, there is a dualism between nature and that which is beyond nature. For Aristotle, there is no dualism. Nature is the here and now, and that's all there is. Plato tended to emphasize the unchanging features of reality and thinking. Aristotle favored explanation in terms of change and motion. Plato used mathematical models, if you will, to explain things. Aristotle was drawn toward biological models of explanation. In ethics, Plato wanted norms that were unchanging. In ethics, Aristotle was more interested in what the outcome of our behavior is, the telos or aim in terms of which we behave. Plato looked for a better world beyond our ordinary experience. Aristotle had a matter-of-fact interest in the world of daily experience. I want you to understand that these lists of contrasts, though they're somewhat general and can be cleaned up and made more precise, they represent enduring philosophical perspectives. Throughout history, you have people that are more Platonic in their approach, more rational, more oriented toward unity and math and those things which transcend nature. And then you have people that are more like Aristotle, the here and now, the diversity of our experience, of being empirical. Plato and Aristotle, though they differed with one another in their systematic philosophies, nevertheless agreed with one another in opposing certain things in their own day. Their systematic philosophy stood over against materialistic hedonism, stood over against the view that all reality is matter and you should live for pleasure. Their philosophies stood over against relativistic sophism. The sophist in their day said, no one knows anything for sure, so what you have to do is learn to get along in this world, learn to win arguments. As I told the class back then, the sophists were the lawyers of their day, right? The hired guns. It's like, it makes no difference. It's just like, who can use his mouth to win the argument? That's all that really counts. That's because everything's relative. No one can know for sure. And then, as you might imagine, because students of philosophy are tempted toward this, there were cynics back then who said, you know, none of these guys know what they're talking about, and civilization's just a big mess, and so what we need to do is get back to nature. So the cynics said, live like dogs. That's where the name cynicism comes from, the Greek word kainos, dog. Dogs don't worry about going into a restroom to go to the bathroom. They're just natural. And so we need to be natural. We were just celebrating a few weeks ago, you know, 20 years ago, we had the great natural exhibition of Woodstock, you know, the hippie culture, back to nature, right? Be free. Hey. I can't get on this subject. It's too interesting. I get you. Okay. And so Plato and Aristotle, though they differ with one another in philosophy, together stand over against other kinds of philosophy, which are materialistic, hedonistic, or cynical. You're getting some idea then in the ancient world of the problems of philosophy and the kinds of answers that are given to them. And then God gave the answer. And he sent his Son, who came into this world as the Word of God, the Logos of God. God, of course, had been preparing the world for that through his people, the Jews. He had given a revelation of himself in the Old Covenant that told us where the world came from and something important about its nature and makeup. It came from God himself as he spoke his word, and it was controlled by God. It's upheld by his power. And man's problems, how we should live, our values, the reason why we have questions about this and we have difficulties in society is because we've rebelled against our maker. And Christ came into this world to take care of man's moral dilemma, his guilt before God, but also came into this world as the light of men, so that we might understand who we are, what we're supposed to live for, and how we know what we know, and so forth. And so if you look at from a Christian perspective, which is, I think, the true perspective, you look at the history of philosophy, you see men struggling with what is nature? What is reason? What is value? And we have these different systematic approaches. They conflict with each other, and there are different schools of philosophy. But then God shows the answer. He gives the light of his Son, Jesus Christ. And so now the history of philosophy is going to take on a new character, and that is, what is the relationship between what the world thinks about nature and reason and value and what God has shown in his Son and through his Word? So when we come into the Middle Ages, you'll notice that the primary problem in the philosophy of the Middle Ages is, what's the relationship of faith and reason? How should man's reasoning relate to man's faith in God, in particular the Christian faith? Problems in the Middle Ages, philosophical problems, took on a theological cast then, because there's questions now about, what's the nature of God? Is God the all encompassing, kind of a pantheistic approach? Or do we take a more dualistic approach, creator and creature? Is God primarily will and power, a voluntaristic view of God? Or is God supreme intellect, reason, and truth? And how do we know God? Do we know God through our natural reasoning? Or do we know God through his special revelation? Both? Neither? What's the relationship between the two? In the Middle Ages, questions were raised about temporal superiority. Who rules in time and space? Who's the superior supreme power in time and space? Granted that God is the supreme power outside of time and space, the state, of course, is just beginning to show some development in the Middle Ages, but is it a civil authority, a family authority, or is the church authority supreme? These are problems that the Middle Ages had to face. How should we live our lives, in terms of the right motive or the right goal? At the end of the Middle Ages, where we see the seeds of the Renaissance being planted, perhaps in the most general abstract way, we could say the problem has become the dichotomy of faith and reason. You have some philosophers who are saying, well, faith teaches one thing, and that's fine if you're talking about theology or if you're talking about values. But we have to use our reason when it comes to understanding the world of what we now call science or nature. So faith deals with the supernatural, theology, and ethics, whereas reason deals with the world of nature and what is the beginning at the time of the Renaissance of what we might call science. Duns Scotus, philosopher at the end of the Middle Ages, argued that divine illumination is not needed for natural knowledge, that man's reason is sufficient to learn about the world and to avoid skepticism. The skeptic says you can't know anything for sure. But reason is adequate to fight against skepticism, according to Duns Scotus. And it does not require divine illumination. So man's reason stands basically all right, adequate in itself. But God does give divine illumination in areas of faith. So you have these two realms, and this is one way of relating them. William of Ockham went even further. William of Ockham, in planting the seeds of the Renaissance, by secularizing philosophy, reason, and science altogether. He said, faith and reason are radically separate spheres. They may contradict each other. They're so separate. But you need to realize that reason operates by its own authority, And faith does not intrude upon reason. So as we come into the Renaissance and then the period of the Enlightenment, all of those problems that I talked about way back when from ancient Greek philosophy, developed from Plato and Aristotle, but now are being dealt with in terms of this. Now, what's the relationship of worldly thinking or reasoning to the illumination and revelation that God has given in His Son Jesus Christ and in the Scriptures? How do faith and reason relate to one another? And the tendency at the end of the Middle Ages is to draw a distinction between the two. Well, as you can probably tell, if you begin to secularize man's reasoning to deals with nature and science, we're heading back to the bad old days of the Greeks, aren't we? Now, how are we going to resolve these problems of oneness and manyness, identity and change? How do we know what we know, and so forth? We get to the Enlightenment. Philosophy can be said to now hinge on the theory of knowledge. How do we know what we know? And the theories of knowledge that were developed were autonomous in character, or humanistic, if you will. And so we have different schools of philosophy, different schools of epistemology, theory of knowledge, that develop. One is, in retrospect, known as continental rationalism, a rationalistic approach that dominated philosophy on the continent of Europe, and the other, British empiricism, a more empirical approach that dominated in Great Britain. The rationalist said that philosophy should begin with clear and distinct ideas. Stop and reflect on what you know to be very sure in the nature of the case, what is self-evident. And from those truths, you can deduce answers to the nature of reality and man and how he should live his life. These innate ideas, the rationalist felt, were a foundation for a worldview. But the problem is, the worldview, the metaphysical inferences of the continental rationalist conflicted with each other. Descartes was a dualist. Spinoza was a monist. Leibniz was an atomist. And they all were supposed to be starting with clear and distinct ideas. And so the British empiricist, looking at that nonsense, said, well, get rid of innate ideas. There are no innate ideas. All we know is based on experience. As Locke said, man comes into the world, the tabula rasa, blank mind. And all that he knows comes from experience, writing on that blank tablet. But with the rejection of innate ideas and trying to rest everything on man's experience, the British empiricists were led step by step to deny metaphysical knowledge. Locke began by saying, the substance of things, what they are, that, if you will, carries all the attributes that we experience. The underlying substance is I know not what. But at least he was willing to say there is such a substance. There is an enduring identity to all the changing appearances in this object out here. Bishop Berkeley argued that there is no material substance because we don't ever experience matter. We only experience our ideas or our sensations, which are not matter. And so here we have substance, I know not what. Now it's no longer material substance, and then we get to David Hume, and he says, well, guess what? We don't experience any substance at all. We don't see any enduring, we don't experience any enduring identity in anything. This table that I'm looking at, I don't see an enduring identity. I only see the attributes of the table, and they are changing. slightly, but nevertheless they are changing. David Hume says, I don't see any causality in this world either. I see one event, then another event, and I've built up the habit of thinking event A brought event B along, but all I know is that there's really sequence, but I don't see any causality. And so at the end of the Enlightenment period, if you will, philosophy has worked itself into a completely skeptical outlook. We can't know anything. So how are things going? I mean, from the days of the early Greeks, as things work out, faith gets separated from reason, and reason takes a nosedive right into skepticism. And so the real question is, can we find a worldview that will save objectivity, rationality, and morality? Remember those three things I said way back when Plato and Aristotle were trying to maintain? Well, that then brings us to the end of the Enlightenment, and I'd like to take a little bit longer time now to review two philosophers in particular, because they are so important for 19th century philosophy, and those two are Rousseau and Kant. Rousseau and Kant. All right, first of all, Rousseau. Rousseau and Kant represent really two different mindsets about philosophy. They're really quite different in their approach to philosophy, and this is what is important for us in trying to understand the 19th century, because the 19th century is going to show a parallel development, if you will, of the spirit of Rousseau in Romanticism and the spirit of Kant in idealism and rationalism and so forth. Rousseau was very sentimental, if you will, in his approach to the world and what we know. His emphasis was upon feeling, and in particular, an emphasis upon feeling the world directly. It was very important that we get back to nature and simply have an experience of nature, not the rational kind of experience that dissects and studies and does research and amasses data, but we just simply enjoy the natural world. There's an emphasis here upon the immediacy of feeling. Rather than mediating the world through your mind and rationality, if you will, just immediately feel the world. You all have some idea of what I'm talking about here? There's a difference between being out on a nice, warm day in nature and appreciating, say, the roses that you see. But you don't stop and ask yourself, what makes roses be roses? You don't say, now what is the distinction between a rose and a carnation? When you start asking questions like that, you're being intellectual, you're trying to be rational, you're drawing distinctions, you're asking questions about causality, all those sorts of things. Am I right? You all know the difference between simply savoring an experience and trying to reflect on and understand your experience. There's quite a difference between eating a hot fudge sundae and doing the chemical analysis of chocolate and ice cream and so forth that went into the sundae. Correct? In fact, most of you know, because there are so many people in our culture today that are killjoys, that if you get too rational about what you're eating, it can interfere with your enjoyment of eating it. Okay, so let's say you really love Mexican food, and there you are over lunch one day eating your burritos and your enchiladas and so forth, and here's a newspaper account that somebody's done this analysis of how much, you know, fat and cholesterol and other bad things are there. And so this rational approach to Mexican food is now beginning to to get in the way of your enjoying the Mexican food that you're eating while you're reading that article. Okay, and I give this to you as an illustration so you know the difference between an immediate approach to your experience and an immediate is that direct enjoyment of the experience, and a mediated approach through reasoning. Rousseau said, enjoy the world, experience the world, be direct. Kant was quite a different kind of philosopher. Kant insisted that our minds have got to make sense of things. And so our approach to the world, our encounter with the world, is mediated by reasoning. All right, so in Rousseau, we see philosophy that is in the romantic vein. I trust you all know that the word romantic is not being used in the narrow sense of boyfriend and girlfriend relationships. But romanticism that emphasizes feeling and a direct empathy and maybe intuition of reality in the world. Rousseau said, man is naturally good. He's born good. He's born innocent. Men are born free and they are born equal with one another. And they should live their lives guided by the instincts of their hearts because they are basically good, free, and equal. Well, where does evil come from? What's the difficulty then? It's because we've gotten away from nature. We've gotten away from our direct feelings, our savoring of the world directly. Civilization has come along and has corrupted us. Reasoning has come along and confused us. And so with Rousseau, we have the ideal of what's called the noble savage. You know, if we want to take care of our problems, we need to get back to that level that is sometimes by civilized people called savagery. But the savages, before civilization came along, were noble individuals. As Rousseau said, man is born free, but everywhere he is in chains. And so Rousseau would free us from our chains and get us back to nature, into the nobility of a direct, empathetic savoring of the world. Rousseau thought the most natural form of social organization was the family, and he made the family, therefore, the model of the state. If we're going to have a social arrangement, it should be somewhat like the family. He wrote the book in 1762 entitled The Social Contract. Sovereignty should rest with the people as they enter into a voluntary contract to develop a state. Rousseau taught that the salvation of man would come through education, if education would be reformed so as to develop the natural impulses of men, their feelings and their sentiment. And so here you have a voluntary contract approach to the state, a view that education is the salvation of man, and that education should be reformed along romanticistic or romantic lines. Rousseau argued that men should be forced or compelled to be free, that their best interest is found in the will of all, in the general will of the people. Not the will of all selfish individuals, but people who choose what is best for everyone in general. The minority is rightly compelled to go along with the majority here because it's really in their best interest. He developed a religion of the heart, we may say. It's not that we should prove God, we should rather feel that God exists. Religion should not be tied to any particular creed Religion is that universal underlying feeling of the heart as it savors the natural world directly. In chapter 1 of Paul Johnson's book, Intellectuals, Johnson deals with Rousseau and calls him the first of the modern intellectuals, their archetype, in fact. There's a sense in which Rousseau sets the pattern, lifestyle-wise, and the way culture responded to him, of the modern guru, where people go, oh, you know, what's this intelligent person telling us and how we can solve our problems? And Johnson does a very nice job. I'm really impressed at how well and how compact his explanation is of Rousseau's distinctives. He lists 5 distinctives, and I'm following Johnson here. This is pages 3 and 4 if you want to look at it yourself. He said Rousseau altered some of the basic assumptions of civilized man. First of all of our modern ideas of education are affected to some degree by Rousseau's doctrine. You see how much emphasis the modern world puts on education? We'll see this in John Dewey when we come to that part of our course. But in America, education is supposed to solve our problems, right? Not doing a great job. We're moving to quite a period of cynicism about that. But it's to Rousseau that we look for this emphasis on education as salvation. Secondly, as Johnson says, linked to Rousseau's revaluation of nature. Take a nature hike. Go out there, experience the world. Get in touch, you know, with your feelings. Linked to this revaluation of nature, Rousseau taught distrust of the progressive, gradual improvements brought about by the slow march of materialist culture. Reason itself has severe limitations for Rousseau as a means of curing society. He didn't mean by that the human mind was inadequate to bring about the necessary changes, because the human mind has within it a hidden, untapped resource of poetic insight and intuition, which can be used to overrule the sterilizing dictates of reason. Okay. So distrust civilization and rationality. Get in touch with your intuitive feelings. Thirdly, Rousseau is responsible for what Johnson calls the Romantic movement and modern introspective literature. Modern introspective literature that puts the focus on the individual, but the Renaissance had put an emphasis on the individual. With Rousseau and then the Romantics following him, the emphasis is upon the inner life of the individual. Discover his feelings, his subjective perspective. Fourthly, according to Johnson, Rousseau popularized the idea that when society evolves from its primitive state of nature to urban sophistication, man is corrupted. When man enters into a more civilized form of social organization, his natural selfishness becomes competitive and acquisitive, and so he is now alienated from other men because they are no longer brothers in the family of man, but competitors with him. But this alienation from other men induces a kind of psychological sickness in man, a tragic divergence between reality as we know it intuitively, and as it appears in the civilized, rational, competitive approach of Rousseau's day. And so this led, fifthly, then, to Rousseau's distrust of private property and his view of it as the source of social crime. As Johnson says, On the very eve of the Industrial Revolution, Rousseau was to develop the elements of a critique of capitalism by identifying property in the competition to acquire it as the primary cause of alienation. This became the thought deposit of Karl Marx. And I think Johnson is right. When you look at it, it's just amazing in that one man, Rousseau, the guru, you see, in the sense of modern philosophy, you have these ideas which are so wide-ranging, according to Johnson, as to constitute almost by themselves an encyclopedia of modern thought. Here is the modern world, in a sense, distilled. Rousseau, emphasis upon education, emphasis upon revaluing nature, getting back to nature, emphasizing the poetic, intuitive side of man's character. Looking at the individual from inside, subjectively, noting that civilization is the source of corruption to man who is basically naturally good, and particularly attacking private property as the source of our difficulties, and so leading to a critique of capitalism. We have Rousseau by way of this review, but then we have a philosopher that stands over against Rousseau in temperament and approach, and that is Immanuel Kant. Immanuel Kant said that David Hume had awakened him from his dogmatic slumbers. Kant was really impressed with the destructive work of Hume, impressed enough that he gave his life to wanting to undo the skepticism of Hume's philosophy. Hume had said there is no basis for moral absolutes and there's no basis for rationality. We can't know anything scientifically. We can't know anything ethically. We may live habitually by our habits and upbringing to expect cause and effect, and we may live habitually in terms of our feelings, in terms of disapprobating certain things and approbating others, but there's no rational foundation either for science or for ethics. And Kant found that scandalous. He wanted to undo the difficulty. What has happened up until the day of Kant can be put up on the board here in the same way that we've dichotomized faith in reason at the end of the Middle Ages. At the end of the Enlightenment, we have a dichotomy. On the one hand, we have values up here, and man as free. There's a realm of value, a realm where man is free, but then there's also the mechanistic world of nature. Which is value free, if you will. And the problem is, how can that predictable, mechanistic, neutral world of nature allow for man, who has the capacity to choose freely among various things, how can it leave any room for values and for ethics? Now, if you've listened to my summary lecture up to this point, you may be saying, wait a minute, there's an echo here, Dr. Bonson. Didn't you say that was the problem of the ancient Greeks? What is nature and how can there be a place for value in nature? That's right. And so, humanistic autonomous philosophy, it turns out, is now going to be going through the same throes and crises and confusions of ancient Greek philosophy. These are enduring problems unless you begin your philosophy with the revelation of God in His Son, Jesus Christ, and the Word of God. By the time of David Hume, it turns out that man's values have no rational foundation, but also man's view of nature, his scientific approach, has no rational foundation because science can't justify the notion of causality, for instance.